Kant in 90 Minutes by Paul Strathern, continued.
Disc 2.
Kant knew far more about illness than any mere professor of medicine at the University of Königsberg. On this topic, as on all others, he could not tolerate contradiction. Unlike other similarly afflicted egoists, he was invariably right, and he knew it. University professors may have been able to tolerate such treatment, but it proved too much for his servant Lampe, who had to put up with it all the time. After decades of faithful service, Lampe eventually took to the bottle and had to be dismissed. Meanwhile, Kant continued stoically resisting the attentions of his family. He continued to justify his lack of contact with his sisters by explaining that they were not up to his intellectual level. After the death of Newton, it's probable that no one in Europe fulfilled this criterion. When pressed further, he said his sisters were pleasant enough, but he had nothing in common with them because they lacked culture. Yet this excuse was certainly invalid with regard to his brother, who had grown to be a cultured professional man but was equally ignored by Kant. This brother dearly longed for social contact with his famous philosophical sibling and regularly wrote letters to him suggesting that they meet, to no avail. At one stage he pleaded to Kant, "I can no longer bear that such separation should continue. We are brothers." Kant often took as long as 2 years to reply to these letters, claiming he had been too busy to write earlier. At the age of 68, after a delay of 2.5 years in replying to his brother's latest letter begging for a meeting, Kant wrote assuring him that he would bear his brother in his thoughts during the short period of life remaining to him, but he carefully refrained from mentioning any meeting. As he grew older, Kant became increasingly solitary and misanthropic. "Life is a burden to me," he confessed at last. "I am tired of bearing it, and if the angel of death were to come this night and call me from here, I would raise my hand and say, 'God be praised.'" Yet he still continued avidly with his hobby, which was presumably intended to prolong his life. Any thought of putting an end to it all was dismissed. He was not afraid to commit suicide, but it was morally wrong. Increasingly he began suffering from nightmares. Each night in his sleep he would find himself surrounded by footpads, stalked by murderers. The paranoid symptoms are unmistakable. He declared, "Everyone almost hates the other, tries to raise himself above his fellow men, is full of envy, jealousy, and other fiendish vices. Man is not a god, he is a devil." He concluded that if a man were to say and write all he thinks, there would be nothing more horrible on God's earth than man. These last two quotes are curiously revealing of how he must have viewed himself at the end of a crotchety but largely blameless life. It wasn't his fault about Lampe, who could always have sought employment elsewhere, and he may not have seen his sisters, but he regularly sent them money. Kant's natural cheerfulness was now being swamped by the rising tide of his suppressed emotional life. He was certainly unhappy, but he was determined to remain true to himself to the end. He insisted that he didn't mind being unhappy, an attitude quite consistent with his philosophy. In the Critique of Practical Reason, he had declared that he found it astonishing how intelligent men have thought of declaring happiness as a universal practical law. In his view, happiness and morality had nothing essential to do with each other. We may be gratified when we perform an act of virtue, but Kant was unable to comprehend how a mere thought containing nothing sensuous can produce a sensation of pleasure or displeasure. Such could only have been the expression of a mind utterly withdrawn from the emotions. Even the driest of mathematicians acknowledge their pleasure on arriving at a difficult solution. Yet Kant did admit to one experience that regularly gave him pleasure. His secret vice was characteristically solitary. He enjoyed watching birds, and would wait impatiently for their return each spring. According to a colleague, the one joy that nature still allowed him was the return of a warbler that sang outside the window in his garden. Even in his joyless old age this one joy remained to him. If his friend remained away too long, he said, "It must still be very cold on the Apennines." Schaffstein, upon whose brilliantly perceptive sketch of Kant's life I have drawn heavily, suggested that the birds represented freedom for Kant. Yet freedom from what? The tyranny of his own nature, certainly. but also perhaps freedom from thought, that very element which he had allowed to enslave his life, the element with which he sought to imprison the entire world within his system. For the last decade of his life, Kant devoted himself to a mammoth philosophical work which he was never to finish. He intended to call this work Transition from the Metaphysical Foundations of Natural Science to Physics. Unlike Kant's earlier works, this is definitively unreadable. Bravely risking insanity, several experts have tried to scale this Everest of the German metaphysical Himalayas, but have returned gasping for air and incapable of coherent communication. As far as we can gather from these survivors, Kant advances his general a priori structure for a science of nature, showing in exhaustive detail how this can be extended to apply to particular sciences. The emphasis here is on the exhaustive detail. Kant now became a sad figure, his great faculties gradually failing. It is said that hypochondria is often a defense mechanism against paranoia, yet despite diligent and exhaustive practice at his hobby, Kant's paranoia gradually began to get the upper hand. He started to experience pressure on his brain, which he decided was caused by a rare form of electricity in the air. This same electricity he thought responsible for the cat epidemics, which had recently broken out in Copenhagen and Vienna. Such involvement with electrical powers is often associated with schizophrenia. But Kant was never mad. His illness was merely the tight knots that had held him so closely bound throughout his life beginning to loosen. He was fading fast. The few chosen colleagues and favoured students who were invited to dinner would watch in saddened silence as his mind wandered. Then his new servant would lead him away. On October the 8th, 1803, Kant was ill for the first time in his life. He had a mild stroke after eating too much of his favourite English cheese. After 4 months of increasing debilitation, he died, February the 12th, 1804. His last words were, "Es ist gut." It is good. He was buried in the cathedral, his tomb inscribed with a statement that inclined him toward the God he certainly believed in but never publicly worshipped, words which harked back to an intense small boy listening to a well-meaning mother whom he certainly worshipped. The starry heavens above and the moral law within fill the mind with an ever new and increasing admiration and awe, the more often and the more steadily we reflect. A Dialogue on Kant and Metaphysics. Question. What is Kant's critique of pure reason about? Answer. Metaphysics. What exactly is metaphysics? This word began as a mistake, and has ended up by being regarded as a mistake. In between times, it was the main topic of philosophy. This still doesn't answer the question. What precisely does metaphysics mean? Nothing at all, according to most modern philosophers. Well, what did it originally mean? This word was first used to refer to certain philosophical works of Aristotle, the ones in his collected works that came after his great work on physics. They became known as the Beyond Physics works, which in Greek was metaphysics. But this still doesn't tell me what it means. In these works, Beyond Physics, Aristotle dealt with the science of things transcending what is physical or natural. And what does that mean? It is the science that deals with the first theoretical principles over and above the physical world. These are the principles that govern our knowledge of that same physical world. In other words, metaphysics deals with whatever transcends the physical world we experience. But how do we know there is anything beyond the physical world we experience? We don't, which is why most modern philosophers dismiss such metaphysics as a mistake. But Kant didn't. Kant was determined to create a new metaphysics. Before him, Hume had arrived at much the same conclusion as those modern philosophers. Hume thought he had destroyed the possibility of metaphysics. How? By doubting everything that he couldn't confirm from his own experience. This extreme scepticism ruled out all kinds of things that humanity had believed in through the centuries, but had never actually experienced. Such as God, for instance. But what Hume said didn't seem to make much difference. People still went on believing in God. Yes, but it was not increasingly understood that they did this through a leap of faith rather than as a result of direct experience or rational argument. So Hume's disproof of metaphysics didn't make any difference at all. In fact, it made a huge difference, especially to scientists and philosophers. How? In ruling out everything except what we can verify through experience, Hume ruled out a lot more than God. More important for the scientists and philosophers, he ruled out causality. How? According to Hume, all we know from experience is that one thing follows another. We can never know that one thing causes another. We cannot go beyond our experience and say that. We never actually experience one thing causing another, only one thing following another. So, this strikes at the heart of all our scientific knowledge. According to Hume, science based on causality is metaphysical, not empirical. It can never be verified. And verification is the very basis of our knowledge. Likewise, philosophy. According to Hume, we can never prove the statements of philosophy unless they are a result of direct experience. Such as? Such as the statement, "This apple is green." But that means philosophy can say practically nothing. Precisely. And this is the extreme difficulty that Kant tried to overcome in his philosophy. How? He tried to show that despite Hume's devastating skepticism, it was still possible to build a metaphysics. This would be the basis for a universal and logically necessary form of knowledge, one that would remain impervious to Hume's skepticism. Kant first set this down in his Critique of Pure Reason. So Kant's metaphysics was an attempt at some kind of ultimate science which guarantees the truth of our knowledge. Precisely. And how did he set about this? Kant put forward what he called his critical philosophy. This undertook a profound analysis of epistemology, a study of the very basis on which our knowledge rests. According to Kant, we make certain judgments that are indispensable to all knowledge. These judgments he classified as synthetic a priori. By synthetic he meant they were not analytic, and the knowledge they contained was not implied in the original concept. For instance, the ball is round is an analytic statement, because the concept roundness is contained within the concept ball. But the ball is shiny is a synthetic judgment. It says something more about the ball than is contained in the original concept, in the same way as an empirical statement. By a priori, Kant meant judgments that are necessary and universal. They had to be true prior to any experience, and are made by the use of reason alone. Unlike judgments made as a result of experience, they are not particular and contingent. That is, they don't just apply to one instance and have no logical necessity, such as statements like, "This horse has won the Derby," and "That horse is brown." Like any scientific judgment, these synthetic a priori statements must be undeniable and universally true. In other words, they must have the same force and strength as an analytic statement, though they are synthetic, and they must be applicable to experience while remaining prior to it. Kant's basic question was, how are synthetic a priori statements possible? He now applied this question to mathematics, physics, and metaphysics. According to Kant, mathematics deals with space and time. Kant argued that, contrary to appearances, space and time are in fact a priori. That is, they are not part of our experience, but a necessary prior condition of that experience. We could have no experience without these forms of our sensibility. Kant then goes on to argue that statements of physics are a priori judgments. They classify empirical judgments and are thus synthetic, but use concepts that are prior to experience and are thus a priori. These concepts, or categories of our understanding, as Kant called them, are much like space and time in mathematics. The categories are the essential framework of our knowledge. They consist of such things as quality, quantity, relation, including causality, and modality, such as existence or non-existence. They are not part of our experience, yet we could not have any experience without them. When we come to metaphysics, however, the opposite is true. Metaphysics has nothing to do with experience, as it is beyond physics. This means we cannot apply categories, such as quantity and quality, to metaphysics, because these are the framework of our knowledge of experience. Thus, metaphysics excludes itself from the realm of synthetic a priori judgments and has no scientific basis. So if we take a metaphysical concept, such as God, we cannot make any scientific or verifiable statement about him, because any categories we might apply are relevant only to experience. Thus, the talk of the existence or non-existence of God is to misapply the categories. In this way, Kant dismissed metaphysics, yet in doing so he built up his own alternative metaphysical system. The way Kant saw them, the forms of our understanding, space and time, as well as the categories of our understanding, including existence, necessity, and so on, are undeniably metaphysical. We may consider space and existence to be out there in the physics of our experience, but Kant did not. So his argument against metaphysics applies equally to them. We can make no synthetic a priori statements about them. They are not scientific, they are not analytic, and they are not logically necessary. They are metaphysical. And if, on the other hand, they are out there in our experience, they certainly cannot be a priori concepts of our understanding. Kant's Critique of Practical Reason attempts to apply a very similar system to ethics. Instead of asking if there are such things as synthetic a priori judgments, he asks if there are rules which a priori govern our will and can thus claim to be universal. Instead of the categories, he comes up with a categorical imperative, which is not a part of actual moral experience, but the a priori framework necessary for it. This categorical imperative he expresses as follows: act only in accord with a principle which you would at the same time will to be a universal law. Like the categories, this imperative is purely formal. The categories have no empirical content. The categorical imperative has no moral content. This categorical imperative may appear all very well, but it is wide enough to encompass the contradictory moralities of the sadomasochist as well as the peace and love hippie. It is also strictly rational, and implies that we should regard all human beings as temperamentally identical to ourselves. But our psychology is not strictly rational, and we do not regard others as being temperamentally identical to ourselves, nor do we wish them to be, unless we happen to be a dictator. How can we even apply such an imperative if we don't think like this or behave like this? We may subscribe to certain universal principles, but these don't cover all our moral actions. There are certain less fundamental principles which we would have no wish to apply to the moral actions of all peoples. I may abstain from cannibalism and at the same time wish to see the principle, eating people is wrong, universally applied. But if I abstain from murder, this does not mean that I wish a policeman to abstain from murdering a murderous hostage-taker. It is possible to argue that such strictures do not apply, as the categorical imperative is merely the framework of morality. By our moral actions, we merely imply universal principles. But such retreat into formality renders the categorical imperative itself utterly vacuous. It plainly states that we should behave in such a way that we wish all other people to behave. From Kant's Writings. The following excerpt is from the opening of the Critique of Pure Reason, where Kant prepares to lay the foundations of his philosophy. As can be seen from the second sentence, Kant begins as he means to go on. Persevere beyond this easily spotted ambush, and you will soon become aware of a quality of mind that nimbly transcends the quagmire of its conveyance. It is beyond a doubt that all our knowledge begins with experience. For by what should our faculties be roused to act, if not by objects that affect our senses, and thus partly of themselves produce impressions, partly, again, bring the understanding itself into movement, in order to compare these, to join or disjoin them, and in this manner work up such crude material of the intimations of sense into a cognition or recognition of objects, which is named experience. So far as time is concerned, then, no cognition of ours precedes experience, and with experience all our knowledge begins. Kant goes on to argue, though all our knowledge begins with experience, it does not follow that therefore it all derives from experience, for it is just possible that experience is itself a compound. It is just possible, that is, that there is experience besides what is due to the impression of sense, something in addition that comes from our faculties themselves, when merely acting because of impression. And in that case, it would take long practice, it may be, to enable us to distinguish the latter and separate it from the former. He then asks, can there really be such component part of knowledge as is independent of experience, and indeed of any impression of sense whatever? Such component part of knowledge, did it exist, was alone to be termed truly a priori, and it would evidently stand in contradistinction to what other component part of knowledge is called empirical, the latter, namely, having its source only a posteriori, or in experience. Kant now goes further into the notion of a priori. The expression a priori, at the same time, is not precise enough to designate the entire sense of the preceding question. For of many a mere empirical fact, we say that we know it a priori simply because we do not derive it directly from experience, but from a general rule. And this, even notwithstanding that the rule itself may be so derived. For example, we say of a man that shall have undermined his house, he might have known a priori that it would fall in. He had no occasion to wait for the experience of the actual event. Nevertheless, he could not have known this absolutely a priori, for that bodies are heavy and consequently fall when their supports are withdrawn, this at least he must have known by experience beforehand. In what follows, therefore, we shall understand by cognitions a priori, not such as are independent of this or that experience, but such as are totally independent of any experience whatsoever. Opposed to these are empirical cognitions, or such as are only possible a posteriori, or from experience. Pure, again, are those a priori cognitions which are quite free from all and every empirical admixture. Thus, for example, the proposition that all change has its cause is an a priori proposition, but it is not at the same time purely such, for change is an idea which can only be derived from experience. All the above quotes from Critique of Pure Reason, 2nd edition, 1787, Introduction, Part 1. The argument continues, and the plot thickens. This extremely rare opportunity to accompany one of the finest intellects in history as it proceeds on its original way should not be missed. To aspire to attain such heights easily defeats the entire purpose of the exercise. What is wanted here is a criterion by means of which we may, with certainty, distinguish what is pure from what is empirical. Now experience informs us that something is so and so, but not that it cannot be otherwise. Firstly, then, should there be a proposition such that it is thought together with its necessity, then it is a judgment a priori, and, if underived from any other, absolutely a priori. Secondly, experience extends to its judgments never strict or true, but only, through induction, assumptive or comparative universality, so that, properly, it can only be said, so far as we are yet aware, there is no exception to this or that rule. Should any judgment then be thought in strict universality, or so, that is, that exceptions are impossible, we may be sure that that judgment is no derivative from experience, but directly a priori. Empirical universality, therefore, is only an arbitrary raising of validity from that which obtains in most cases to that which holds good in all, as in the proposition, for example, that all bodies are heavy. Whereas when strict universality attaches to a judgment, such universality points to a special cognitive source, namely to a faculty of cognition a priori. Necessity and strict universality, therefore, are sure criteria of a priori cognition and inseparably found together. In practice, however, as it is easier now to apply the one and now the other, it will be advisable to avail ourselves, as occasion may suggest, of either criterion separately, for, even separately, either of them is quite infallible. He continues with a bravura display of German metaphysical argument. Like any good medicine, this should be taken slowly and repeatedly. Only then do its efficacious qualities begin to emerge. Now, it is easy to show that there actually are in our knowledge such necessary and, in the strictest sense, universal, consequently pure a priori, judgments. Would we have an example from science, we have only to turn to any proposition in mathematics. While, as for the most ordinary common sense, there is obviously to hand, by way of instance, the proposition that every change must have a cause, where the very notion cause so manifestly implies necessity of connection with an effect, and strict universality of rule, that it would be altogether lost, did we derive it, like Hume, from our conjoining what simply follows with what simply precedes, through the mere habit of experience, and the consequent simple custom of connecting ideas, where the necessity could only be subjective. Besides demonstrating the actual existence in our knowledge of principles a priori by a reference to fact, we might even a priori prove as much. We might demonstrate, that is, the indispensable necessity of such principles to the very possibility of experience. For how should there be any certainty in experience, were all the rules in it only empirical and consequently contingent? It was hardly possible, evidently, to allow any such rules the name of first principles. But it may suffice here to have demonstrated the fact of the possession of pure cognition on our part, together with the signs of the latter. Nay, not merely judgments, but even certain ideas may claim for themselves an a priori origin. Suppose, in the case of our empirical idea of a body, we successively withdraw all its empirical constituents, such as colour, consistency, weight, even impenetrability, we shall still find it impossible to withdraw the space it occupied. This space will still remain when the body itself has disappeared. In like manner, if, in regard to our empirical idea of an object in general, whether corporeal or incorporeal, we withdraw all properties known to us from experience, we shall still be unable to withdraw from it those by which we think it as substance, or as attributive to substance, though this notion of substance has more determination in it than that of an object in general. We must, therefore, overborne by the necessity with which said notion forces itself upon us, admit that it has its seat a priori in our faculties of cognition. Above quotes from Critique of Pure Reason, 2nd edition, 1787, Introduction, Part 2. Here Kant explains the notion of time according to his philosophy. Time has no objective reality. It is not an accident, not a substance, and not a relation. It is a purely subjective condition, necessary because of the nature of the human mind, which coordinates all our sensibilities by a certain law, and is a pure intuition. We coordinate substances and accidents alike according to simultaneity and succession only through the concept of time. Collected Works, Volume 2. Here Kant differentiates between different kinds of happiness. This comes from his essay On the Beautiful and the Sublime. Because someone is only happy in so far as he gratifies a desire, the feeling that causes him to enjoy such great pleasures without him needing great ability in order to do so is certainly no trivial matter. Fat people, whose favourite artists are their cooks and whose masterpieces lie in their cellar, enjoy their common obscenities and vulgar witticisms just as much as nobler souls enjoy their more refined pursuits. An indolent fellow who loves to have books read aloud to him because he enjoys falling asleep in this fashion. The businessman who considers all pleasure a distraction, apart from working out his profits on a smart business deal. Someone who loves the opposite sex for the sheer pleasure of it and nothing else. The keen hunter, whether he merely hunts flies like the Roman Emperor Domitian, or ferocious beasts like A. All these have feelings which make them capable of experiencing pleasure in their own way, without them being envious of others, or even being capable of conceiving of other pleasures. This kind of feeling, which can take place without any thought at all, I shall completely disregard. Fine feeling, which I shall now consider, is for the most part of two kinds, the feeling of the sublime and that of the beautiful. Each gives us pleasure, but in different ways. The sight of a snow-capped mountain peak rising above the clouds, the description of a wild storm, or Milton's depiction of the kingdom of hell, each of these gives us joy, but mingled with terror. On the other hand, the sight of flower-covered meadows, valleys with winding streams and grazing flocks, the description of Elysium, or Homer's depiction of the girdle of Venus, these also give us a pleasant sensation, but one that is joyful and happy. In order to feel the former sensation, we must have a feeling of the sublime. But in order to experience the latter properly, we must have a feeling of the beautiful. On the Beautiful and the Sublime, Section 1. A rare example of Kantian poetry. This was written in 1782 on the occasion of the death of Pastor Lilienthal, who had married Kant's parents. Was auf das Leben folgt, deckt tiefe Finsternis. Was uns zu tun geburt, des sind wir nur gewiss. What comes after life is hidden in deep darkness. What we are expected to do, that alone we know. An even rarer example, this time of Kantian humour, a somewhat desiccated and elusive quality. This comes from the opening of his essay, Perpetual Peace. Perpetual Peace. Whether this satirical inscription on a Dutch innkeeper's sign, upon which a churchyard was painted, has for its object mankind in general, or in particular the governors of states who are insatiable of war, or whether it points merely towards those philosophers who indulge the sweet dream of a perpetual peace, it is impossible to decide. The following goes a long way toward explaining the popularity of Kant's geography lectures with the citizens of Königsberg. It was written by Dr. J. H. Stirling, a 19th-century British member of the Philosophical Society of Berlin. In Kant's geography lectures, he cannot help referring to some of the most interesting facts that have reached him. Negroes are born white, all to a ring around the navel. The ibis dies the moment it quits Egypt. The lion is so noble he will not put a paw upon a woman. If you make a cup of the rhinoceros's horn, any poison will splinter it. There is a muscle in Italy that gives out so much light that you can read by it. In Languedoc there is a hot spring that hatches eggs. Wild beasts eat only negroes in Gambia and leave Europeans alone. The negroes in America are immensely fond of dog's flesh, and all the dogs bark at them. According to Dr. Stirling, these views were all gravely propounded. Chronology of Kant's life. April the 22nd, 1724. Immanuel Kant born in Königsberg in East Prussia. 1737. Kant's mother dies. 1741. Kant enters the University of Königsberg. 1746. Kant's father dies, and he is forced to leave the university to support himself as a private tutor. 1755. He finally takes his degree at the University of Königsberg. 1755. Becomes Privatdozent, equivalent of junior lecturer, at the university, and delivers lectures on mathematics, philosophy, anthropology, and physical geography. 1770. Appointed Professor of Logic and Metaphysics. 1781. Publishes Critique of Pure Reason. 1788. Publishes Critique of Practical Reason. 1790. Publishes Critique of Judgment. October 1803. Falls ill for the first time in his life. February 12, 1804. Dies and is buried in Königsberg Cathedral. Chronology of Kant's era. 1739. The Scottish philosopher David Hume publishes A Treatise of Human Nature. 1743, Birth of Thomas Jefferson. 1750-1752, Voltaire takes up residence at the court of Frederick II of Prussia in Potsdam. 1751, Death of French philosopher Lemaître. 1759, Founding of British Museum. 1762, Rousseau publishes Émile, which causes Kant to break his routine and miss his afternoon walk. 1770, Birth of Hegel. 1774, Goethe publishes The Sorrows of Young Werther. 1776, American Declaration of Independence, Death of Hume. 1778, Death of Rousseau. 1789, French Revolution, George Washington becomes first President of the United States. 1799, Napoleon becomes first Consul of France. 1804, Napoleon becomes ruler of Germany. Chronology of significant philosophical dates. 6th century BC, the beginning of Western philosophy, with Thales of Miletus. End of the 6th century BC, death of Pythagoras. 399 BC, Socrates sentenced to death in Athens. Circa 387 BC, Plato founds the Academy in Athens, the first university. 335 BC, Aristotle founds the Lyceum in Athens, a rival school to the Academy. 324 AD, Emperor Constantine moves capital of Roman Empire to Byzantium. 400 AD, St. Augustine writes his Confessions, philosophy absorbed into Christian theology. 410 AD, sack of Rome by Visigoths heralds opening of Dark Ages. 529 AD, closure of Academy in Athens by Emperor Justinian marks end of Hellenic thought. Mid-13th century, Thomas Aquinas writes his commentaries on Aristotle, era of Scholasticism. 1453, fall of Byzantium to Turks, end of Byzantine Empire. 1492, Columbus reaches America, Renaissance in Florence and revival of interest in Greek learning. 1543, Copernicus publishes On the Revolution of the Celestial Orbs, proving mathematically that the Earth revolves around the Sun. 1633, Galileo forced by Church to recant heliocentric theory of the universe. 1641, Descartes publishes his Meditations, the start of modern philosophy. 1677, death of Spinoza allows publication of his Ethics. 1687, Newton publishes Principia, introducing concept of gravity. 1689, Locke publishes Essay Concerning Human Understanding, start of empiricism. 1710, Berkeley publishes Principles of Human Knowledge, advancing empiricism to new extremes. 1716, death of Leibniz. 1739-1740, Hume publishes Treatise of Human Nature, taking empiricism to its logical limits. 1781, Kant, awakened from his dogmatic slumbers by Hume, publishes Critique of Pure Reason. Great era of German metaphysics begins. 1807, Hegel publishes The Phenomenology of Mind, high point of German metaphysics. 1818, Schopenhauer publishes The World as Will and Representation, introducing Indian philosophy into German metaphysics. 1889, Nietzsche, having declared God is dead, succumbs to madness in Turin. 1921, Wittgenstein publishes Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, claiming the final solution to the problems of philosophy. 1920s. Vienna Circle propounds logical positivism. 1927. Heidegger publishes Being and Time, heralding split between analytical and continental philosophy. 1943. Sartre publishes Being and Nothingness, advancing Heidegger's thought and instigating existentialism. 1953. Posthumous publication of Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigations, High Era of Linguistic Analysis. This concludes the reading of Kant in 90 Minutes by Paul Strathern. The book was read by Robert Whitfield. For other audiobooks from the Philosophers in 90 Minutes series, or if you would like to obtain a complete printed catalogue of our titles or our monthly update telling you about new releases and our new collection of books on CD, write to Blackstone Audiobooks, P.O. Box 969, Ashland, Oregon 97520, or call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. You may also obtain the same information from our award-winning website. Our address, all one word, is www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.